You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. In just a moment, we're going to be talking about movies and art here on the Radio Cafe, but first, just a few words from our beloved sponsors. This program is brought to you by Total Wine and More. With locations in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, each store has about 8,000 different wines from all over the world, and thousands of beers, including both major brands and microbrews and imported beers. And they have more than 3,000 different kinds of spirits, all at the lowest prices you'll find, and with a trained, knowledgeable staff. They're on the web at totalwine.com, and you can order for in-store pickup. And if you use my promo code, you can save even more. Use code 6979 at the store or online and receive $10 off on your next $50 purchase. That's code 6979. Thanks again to Total Wine and More for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. The Santa Fe Opera is launching its 62nd season with a spectacular musical journey that features two lovers in search of the best of all possible worlds. Candide is Leonard Bernstein's 20th century masterpiece. On stage at the Santa Fe Opera for the first time, on opening night, and 9 more performances over the course of the summer. To learn more, visit santafeopera.org, where you can find out about all the different operas and purchase tickets. That's santafeopera.org. I'm very happy now to welcome Stuart Ashman. He's Executive Director and Chief Curator at the Center for Contemporary Arts, the CCA, here in Santa Fe, and Jason Silverman, Director of the Cinematheque at the CCA. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's great to be here. We're recording at the CCA today, and there's been some good news, which is that The Screen, which is the very wonderful movie theater at the former College of Santa Fe, former Santa Fe University of Art and Design, now something resembling the zombie apocalypse over there, but it's coming back, ladies and gentlemen, and The Screen is now under management of the CCA.
Yes, in partnership with the City of Santa Fe.
Yeah. So tell us what happened.
Well, you know, very simply, Jason and I have been talking about expanding the cinema offerings for a long time, and we actually were about to undertake the idea of building a third screen here. And I got a phone call one night about 9 o'clock from the mayor, and he said, "Hey, I'm just finishing dinner. Will you be available in about a half an hour?" And I said, "Sure." And he called me back, and he says, "We got The Screen. Are you interested in that?" And of course, I talked to Jason, and he had already talked to me about The Screen, so we went and made the deal.
It's a wonderful theater in a city full of wonderful theaters, including the current theaters at the CCA, which had quite a renovation in recent years. And so how are you thinking about it? Is it going to be the same kind of thing, or will it have a distinct character?
It'll have a distinct character. I mean, it was operating as part of a film school for the past 19 years, and the film school is now disappeared. So it was a teaching site for film students, you know, on the college level. And I think also played a lot of esoteric films, wonderful esoteric films, and films that were maybe a little more geared towards North Side audiences. And we hope to turn it into a real community hub. It's right across the street from the Santa Fe High School. It's right over a little fence from the new Milagro School, which will open in August of 2019. We have a very robust educational program at the CCA, so we'll be able to move our educational programs over there. Kids will be able to walk across the street from Santa Fe High and see films. Our educational program features STEAM programming. That's science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. And so we try to weave the films from our educational library into the curricula of science teachers and arts teachers. And we hope to expand that intensively. I mean, we served about 1,200 kids this year. We hope we can double that next year. We also do a lot of community-based programs with partners, some who we've worked with for years and years, you know, Veterans for Peace and the Santa Fe Opera, different environmental groups, etc. So we hope to make that space more available to those partners so that they can, you know, tell their stories through documentary film or otherwise. And we have some other ideas cooking about community-based programming,
which we will hear about in the future, no doubt.
No doubt. And, you know, I think it's true that, because that's my neighborhood, I think it's true that a lot of people who live even right across the street from the university don't know that this theater exists. And that's a shame, because it's a beautiful theater that Midtown, those Midtown neighborhoods are not always as well served by the cultural institutions in the city. And so we hope to kind of plant a flag at the campus and say, you know, arts and culture are for you as well. And, you know, hopefully in doing that, we'll do a little bit to define the identity of the emerging campus too.
Well, that's something that I was going to ask you about, because this is this golden moment where, what is it, 60-plus acre campus is going to develop a new identity with presumably a lot of community input, not just institutional, but citizen and city and everybody else. And we really don't know yet what that's going to be, do we?
Not really. I think the city is, you know, they have a great guy named Matthew O'Reilly, who's the director of the city's asset management. And, you know, he's working to partner with organizations, because this is just, we're basically going to add a lot of credibility, because they can say, well, CCA is there operating the screen. And then another group will take over the Greer Garson Theater, and they can say, this group is running the Greer Garson Theater. And, you know, they're talking to UNM about doing an MFA program at the old Marion Center. So, you know, it'll come alive. And then there'll probably be some commercial stuff in there, because if you get those three entities going, you're going to want a Starbucks in there or something like that.
Right, right.
And
or a locally owned coffee shop.
Exactly.
Even better.
Yet. Better yet. Iconic.
Right.
Yeah. And Jason, tell the listeners about the open air screenings you're
right.
planning.
Well, first, to just answer your question, the mayor described this as a once in a lifetime opportunity. And he kept on saying this campus is at the geographical center of Santa Fe.
Right.
And there's been so much energy put into the idea of developing the St. Mike's corridor and Midtown, and, you know, the success of Meowwolf and the kind of cottage industry that's grown up around there is an example of how you can spread some of the wealth from the north side to Midtown and the south side. And I think Santa Fe will become a lot more vibrant if the city is able to really develop that Midtown campus. It could be something really special. I mean, you see what happens at the rail yard. The rail yard's attracted a lot of energy. The rail yard's still on the north side of town. It's still serving a lot of the same neighborhoods. Midtown is, you know, right in the thick of a lot of the working class neighborhoods. And so we're really excited just about that part. I mean, we're located here. We love being here at the CCA, on the CCA campus. But the idea of being able to do what we do, which is, you know, a lot of it's community-oriented programming, and do it in a neighborhood that, you know, can be really receptive to it, is exciting to us.
It really is part of our mission to be a community servant, and this is going to allow us to do that in a bigger way.
When you say educational programming, part of me just glazes over and goes, oh, that sounds boring. But it's not. I mean, what do you, you know, well, what are you talking about when you say educational program?
Well, our youth partners program is really simple. I mean, we have a library of about a dozen non-educational films. They're documentaries and features. They all have something to do with either science, technology, engineering, the arts, or math.
What are some examples?
One is Particle Fever, which is about the particle collider in CERN, Switzerland.
Oh, yeah, that, like, super hip documentary about a particle collider, yes.
Right, which is, you know, you can't really follow all the science, but it's really
it doesn't
fun to watch the scientists.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really exciting nonstop film. Chasing Ice, Racing Extinction, Tim's Vermeer. We're adding I Am Not Your Negro. So there's all kinds of interesting stuff. We're adding a film called Step, which is about a Baltimore dance team at a school for young women in Baltimore. And basically we have these films, we have a faculty that can talk about the films, and we basically bus kids over from Capitol High and Santa Fe High and Monte del Sol and Mandel and a few others. And the kids watch the film, they've been prepped in class prior, they talk about the film, we serve them pizza. I mean, it's really simple, but it's been radicalizing for a lot of kids. I mean, you know, we had Capital come probably 10 times last year. And some of these kids have never been in a cultural institution like CCA. A lot of them have not seen a documentary outside of the really dull ones they'll see in school. And then they get to have these really intense conversations about things that matter. Chasing Ice is about global warming. Race and Extinction is about extinction. Particle Fever is about kind of the search for meaning through science. And, you know, the kids really engage with this material.
You should write taglines.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Yeah, and, you know, we for example, here we're doing New Mexico School for the Arts Day. So we bring over 100 students here, and they're here for the whole day. The first half, they're in the gallery doing art workshops while the other group is watching a film. And then they have their pizza, and then they switch. So really they have, you know, a full school day that is nothing more than visual arts and cinema.
And pizza
and interaction with whoever is in the cinema talking about it and whoever is in the gallery talking about it. And, you know, the fact that they're not in the classroom really opens them up in a very big way, I think.
Yeah, and all these movies have real-life heroes in them. That's one reason we choose them, because a lot of these young people, they go see superhero movies. And the message of the superhero movie is that if you are endowed with special powers, and then you can help the world, which is really an alienating message when you stop to think of it.
Yeah, well, I always wanted to be Superman.
You are.
Yeah.
You are. You're CCA Superman.
The Invisible Man would be good, too.
So these people have special powers, but the guy who's the central figure in Chasing Ice, he's just this beat-up old photographer with two bad knees, and he's changing the world, you know, one lecture at a time.
Right.
And that's what's really inspiring mm-hmm. about this, and that's really the difference between what independent media and the arts can do versus what commercial media and this commodity-driven storytelling that we see on our TVs and in a lot of the internet and movie theaters. The artists that show in the exhibits that Stuart curates, they do the same thing. I mean, they're giving us an alternative vision of the world. And so, you know, back to the screen, this becomes another place for us to kind of share those stories and share these artists with a larger community.
I mean, I think there's something that's really important about this, and that is that when probably the three of us and many of our listeners were growing up, for example, foreign films were shown in whatever your local movie theater was. They were mainstream, essentially. They weren't necessarily the big, what were the big action movies of our youth, like E.T. or something like that. But now, foreign films aren't as common. They're no longer mainstream. On top of that, there's like a surge of anti-intellectualism. There's the kind of American insularity that we're going through right now, and, you know, hostility on the part of many and on the part of government to some extent toward people from other countries. These are all part of a big piece that work like this is really fighting against in some sense.
Well, I think there is, obviously, in the short term, there is a promotion of intolerance. There's a war on science. There's a war on information. There's a confusion about what's real and what's not. Facts are being obscured. And also, you know, we're being taught to fear one another, which is not new to this administration. I mean, that's something that goes back decades. The crime rates in this country have been going down steadily for decades, but you would never know that from watching the news or reading the newspaper. And we've become more afraid of each other instead of less afraid of each other. And I think what's special about Santa Fe is that we've got the CCA plus, you know, 50 other presenting organizations and a lot of independent businesses, restaurants where people gather. And I think in Santa Fe, people don't fear their neighbors. We have not
They
learned.
Yell at each other.
We do yell at each other. that's inevitable. But we usually make up. And, you know, we haven't become fearful, locking ourselves in our houses, you know, so polarized that we can't have a civil conversation about something that divides us. And, you know, that's why Santa Fe is so special. And that's why it's an amazing place to put together cultural programming, because people respond to it and they really are open to it and genuinely moved by it. So, you know, I'm really inspired by the way that people in this town have responded to this crisis around immigration. You know, people talk about it. People talk, you know, people are having open conversations about it, honest conversations about it. People are supportive. People know first generation immigrants and are supportive. So it's a different kind of vibe here than it is in a lot of places in the country.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take just a quick break now to hear from one of our sponsors. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. As you know, if you're living here in Santa Fe, we had a warm winter and we didn't get enough snow. The snow brings the water we need, and as a result, New Mexico's drought is currently among the worst in the United States. As the summer heats up, water restrictions in Santa Fe will be coming into effect, and we're being called upon to renew our conservation efforts and learn more about what we can do to value our water. Visit facebook.com/SaveWaterSantaFe to take the City of Santa Fe's new drought online quiz and learn not just about the current condition of the drought, but also how to contribute to long-term efforts to maintain a healthy, green, and water-wise Santa Fe. And now back to our program. Stuart Ashman, you were head of the Museum of Latin American Art in California. You've also been here in New Mexico, in Santa Fe. Before that, for many years, you were secretary of the New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs and head of a couple of other museums here. How did your experience in California affect you and affect maybe how you're running or seeing the CCA now?
Well, you know, my role, I mean, I should probably not confess this, but I care more about the people that make the art and look at the art than the art itself, which is probably not the position that a museum director should have. And I always had fights with conservators and curators about that kind of thing, because, yes, the object is precious, but it's not about the object. It's about what's being expressed with the object. And, you know, one of the things that what made me successful in California was, you know, the Museum of Latin American Art didn't accept or exhibit Latino or Chicano art. And there was nothing malicious about it, but it was the founder's idea that he wanted to show the public, the Latino public, how wonderful Latin America is. But what it caused was kind of a feeling of isolation from the people. I said, what do you mean? So this is not our museum. Our people can't show here. And I managed to convince the board to take that policy away. And it just blew the doors open. You know, all of a sudden, all these important Chicano artists were giving works to the museum. We did a show for Luis Tapia, who's from New Mexico, and it was a huge hit. We got Cheech Marin involved and lending pieces from his collection and so on. And now there's a big show for Judith Hernandez, who's, you know, the matriarch of Chicano art in L.A. So that idea of, you know, opening up to the community is really what has always interested me, is, you know, I'm enjoying this art, and I'm not an educated scholar necessarily, so you can appreciate this. And if you have the right intermediaries, we have a great curator of education. He can take you by the hand and explain to you what this abstract painting could mean and really open up people to this idea, open their palates to this flavor that they may not have. They might have been intimidated by it in some way. Art can be pretty intimidating. You know, people are oohing and aahing, and you're looking at a gray wall and you go, well, what's so exciting about that? Well, explain that to me and then maybe I will get it, you know.
Right.
So that's really the thing. And, you know, we have this great team here. Jason's been here for so many years doing exactly the same thing with film that I want to do with the whole place. It's a good fit in that respect. So it's about that for me. It's getting the people involved. And in all of my jobs, that's been the case, you know, was when I was cultural affairs secretary, the door was open. So, you know, if you were an artist working in Truth or Consequences, you could come and show me your work. And if I couldn't take it in the collection or place it, I would at least give you some encouragement, you know, so that you could continue your work. And that's kind of what interests me, what moves me in this world.
Now, when you changed that policy to including Chicano, Latino, American artists at the museum in California, the Museum of Latin American Art, did you find that you got whole new audiences, not only artists, but their communities?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it started with an exchange of emails with teachers that my curator of education shared. And one of them said to another teacher, said, why do you want to go to the white man's museum, the Gabacho Museum? And so I called all the teachers. There were 30 teachers. And I told them, you know, this is your museum. You come here anytime for free. Then we bought a bus and brought the kids for free. And sort of it started to open up the doors in that respect. We also did a show of the collection of Frida Kahlo's photographed. And it was, you know, the highest attendance on record since the opening of the museum. I mean, we had like 8,000 people over the weekend. People were standing in line for 2.5 hours to come in. And that really sort of let them see that we were going to cater to their interest. And so then they were ready to see what was next. The membership grew, almost doubled. When I left, there were 3,500 members. When I came, there were 1,700. So that was all reflective of the community. And Long Beach claims to be the most diverse city in the country. They have the largest Cambodian population. Actually, Cambodians were coming and telling me that they wanted me to do a show, you know. And I said, well, how does that relate to Latin America? And they were trying to find some way to make that happen. But the population is 55% Latino in Long Beach. And it's a city of about 500,000.
Very interesting. So tell us more about what's going on with respect to the visual arts here at the CCA.
Well, we have a, you know, pretty robust program with exhibits. Right now we have Ricardo Masal, who's a Mexican painter. And really it's like four shows because his work is so complex. He travels all over the world and chronicles kind of anthropological stories. Right now he's got this theme on death and burial. Mexico, Bhutan, Tibet, that's all part of it. Then the next show is not a group show, but it's a group of people who are individuals. One of them is David Scheinbaum, Janet Russick. And David has been working, I shouldn't give too much of it away, but in a unique way, you know, he's a master photographer. And over the last 20 years, he's been collecting these, you could say, I don't know if they're racist, but racially stereotyped objects about black people. Piggy banks, kind of Aunt Jemima as an example. And what he did is he photographed them with an 8x10 camera using paper instead of film. So what you get is a negative. So the black people are actually white. And the background, instead of being white, is black. And so he's doing a series along those lines. And Janet's doing a whole series based on the spam that we receive in our emails.
Oh, heavens.
You know, talking about erections superimposed over Greek statues whose penises have fallen off. You know, things like that. And then in another room, we're going to have a series of kind of erotic photographs and prints by a fellow named Paul Cava, who I went to undergraduate and graduate school with. He lives in Philadelphia. And then we have a big installation by Shelley Horton Tripp, who's a longtime Santa Fe painter, sculptor, poet, etc. And we have, of course, Tom Joyce's Inverted Studio. So that winds up this year. And next year, the highlight is Judy Tuwaletztiwa in the summer. And then the following year is Mark Spencer. And then we have all these other shows in between. And, you know, with each show, we put together programming. And so for Ricardo Masal, our board had this idea that this is a time to celebrate Mexico, to contrast how it's been portrayed by the administration. So it's called Mexico Today Beyond the Wall. And we have a series of over a dozen programs, lectures, talks. Jason put together basically a film festival with six films. And we have a couple of filmmakers and film actors coming. Sergio Arau, who did A Day Without a Mexican, is coming. Yareli Arismendi, who is the star of Like Water for Chocolate. And those films are going to be shown both here and the screen. So we're going to have a very busy summer. And, you know, we run this place with a skeleton crew. I mean, Jason has two full-time people, and the CCA administration curator department has three. And that's the whole deal. We run this place with about six full-time people and eight part-time people and a few volunteers.
And you do an amazing job doing it.
Well, thank you.
And it's, you know, it's 70,000 people a year come through. So it's, you know, it's a substantial, you know, a substantial traffic. And we're open 364 days a year. And so it's, but, you know.
What day off?
We're usually closed on Christmas Eve.
And you're open Christmas Day?
We're open Christmas Day.
Ah, that's a good day to go to the movies, actually.
After you open your presents.
That's right.
I wanted to ask you a little more about what's going on in Latin America, Latin American art, Stuart, because, I mean, again, part of this insularity of the media, I mean, if you open pretty much any paper, even reputable papers, it's all about Washington, D.C. And even if you read about the arts, it's not, you don't really get a sense of, like, what's going on in the rest of the world. Okay, the World Cup is happening. That's great. But when you look at, like, what's going on in Mexico and Cuba in terms of the arts, what are some of the movements? Like, what are you seeing? What does it feel like?
Well, I think that, you know, that there's, and this is the kind of art I think both Jason and I are interested in, is that art that makes some kind of social commentary, that we're not just talking about pretty objects. You want it to have some kind of deeper meaning and relevant meaning. And I think a lot of the successful art that's coming out of Latin America is along those lines and making those kinds of statements, whether it's performance art or painting or sculpture or sound, it usually has some context that is relevant to a broader public. And one of the things that I noticed in particular in traveling through Cuba and Mexico, and Cuba in particular, is that art is not for the elite. You know, you can go down to the gas station and the guy pumping gas would know who Ricardo Masal is.
Right.
You know, that's kind of how it works. It's accessible to everybody. It's not like an elite group that likes this particular thing.
Right. It's like that cliche, but it's true about, you know, every Italian cab driver knows opera.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's basically the story.
You know, there's a kind of art that's made thinking about the marketplace. You know, it's commodity driven art, which I think dominates the gallery scenes in most big cities. You know, when you go to Chelsea, New York, and you look around, it's stuff that I don't get. It's conceptual. It's over my head. I'm not, you know, uneducated in this world, in, you know, in this realm. And then there's art that's made from the heart, you know, with a sense of purpose and passion. And I think when you travel to, you know, I spent time in Africa, or probably when you're in Cuba, people who aren't thinking about the marketplace but are making art because they have a story to tell or they have something they need to express, that's the kind of art that moves me personally. And it's the same thing with films. I mean, the world of cinema got radicalized with the advent of digital technologies, because anyone could pick up a camera and tell their story. It wasn't just limited to a select group of white males in Hollywood who can afford this expensive 35 millimeter equipment. And so there's all kinds of interesting stories being told in all kinds of different realms right now.
Right. And you yourself are a filmmaker, and Stuart Ashman, you are a sculptor. So this is an artist-run organization, essentially.
Yeah, well, that's true. And, you know, I actually, going back to what you were saying, I started this whole thing in photography and cinematography. When I started my undergraduate work, I was in cinematography. And what moved me away from it was exactly the commercial piece of it. I had a professor who was actually a professional in the industry, and he took us on a field trip to the industry. And I was completely turned off by it. It was not about art anymore. It was more about creating a product that would be marketable. And so I withdrew and went back to photography, because my sense was that my heroes in cinema were the guys that were going out with a 16 millimeter camera and taking film rather than pictures. And so that was my return to still photography and then from there to everything else.
Did I get it wrong when I said you were a sculptor?
No, that's correct. Yeah, but I started in cinema and, well, I started in photography and then cinema, and then I started drawing and painting, and sculpting is where I ended up.
Yeah, and a lot of these people who are working like you're talking about, they're doing it because they're frustrated that the story that they see in front of them is not being told through the mainstream media. And we had Danny Lyon here, you know, who's one of the great civil rights photographers and yeah. has been based outside of Albuquerque for 30-something years now. And, you know, he just saw stories that were invisible to the world, and he decided to tell those stories with his camera.
Yeah, and, you know, Spike Lee, who, you know, became a hero in the commercial world, but really he started as an underground guy. I mean, Black Power was his thing, right? And he expressed it that way, and he showed the kind of irony that exists in that community.
Yeah, and, you know, what I was asked recently why I'm so interested in indigenous cinema and African cinema, and the reason is if you know, especially 10, 15 years ago, if an indigenous storyteller wanted to put something to film, or someone in Africa wanted to put something to film, you weren't thinking about money, because there was no money to be made. You might have a little dream that you'd break even on it, but you were desperate to tell the story. You were like, you know, you had to dedicate heart and soul to get the story told. And so the works that emerge, even if they might not be as polished as some are and some aren't, they've got passion behind them. They've got like intention behind them. They've got a sense of purpose.
I spent a bunch of time in Peru some years ago, and somebody there was telling me that when he was a kid in his town, Cusco, Peru, when a new kid came from elsewhere, from another town or another country, and was put in their school, all the children gathered around him and said, him or her, and said, "What do you eat where you're from? What are your dances? Sing us your songs." And this kid would be like a star because he was from somewhere else and had a lot to tell and a lot to express. And I feel that way when we get to see a movie from somewhere else. It's like, oh, what is it like where you live? But it was so striking to me when that person was telling me this story, because I thought, you know, when I was a kid and somebody came from another school, we kind of pussyfooted around them until they assimilated to the way we were. We didn't ask them, "What do you eat? Sing us your song," something like that.
That's much more American what you're talking. I mean, it's much more American to wait for the others to assimilate, yeah, rather than to kind of embrace their difference. And, you know, our media culture is reflective of that. You know, if you go to just about any city in the world now, you'll see the same chain restaurants, the same chain stores. It's every city's becoming the same. The media culture is the same way. I mean, the movies look alike, the TV shows look alike. There's a certain way that stories are told, and it squeezes out the idea of difference, of, you know, the whole rainbow of like human experience, the whole spectrum of human experience. And so that's what's really, you know, and that's never been more true than it is now, I think. You know, I think more and more the idea of, you know, kind of making a monolithic media culture exists. And so these storytellers that are working outside of that framework are, you know, they're so important to us.
Yeah. Although there is, I just have to say, there's some really interesting work going on in television these days. There's a lot of stories being told, like Transparent. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Which is quite a story. Which is, you know, from, you know, Amazon's a beast now, but Amazon's an outsider in the film world. Netflix, yeah, is an outsider in the film world. They're beasts now, but 5 years ago, no one would have expected them to be making, mm-hmm, award-winning series. So they came from the outside, and the fact that something like Transparent or Stranger Things even is so popular, it's just a sign that there's a hunger for these stories that come from outside the mainstream.
So what are some of the challenges that independent movie theaters here in Santa Fe are facing? I mean, this is something, now you've got two screens here at the CCA, another screen at the Screen.
No, well, I'll let him give you the bulk of the answer, but I think, you know, when you go to the Lensic or someplace like that, they'll tell you, you know, the head guy will come out and he'll say, you know, "Thank you for being here. And I just want to remind you that the ticket price doesn't cover the cost of this event."
Right.
Because we have all this overhead, we have technicians, etc. And the same is true here. You know, yes, you know, there's people pay their admission fee and so on. But the big challenge, of course, is always, how do we keep this going beyond the movies. And, you know, I think one thing that the public doesn't know is that when you pay $10 to come to the movies, often half of it goes to the distributor. Mm. You know, when you hear that a movie grossed $30 million over the weekend, that's not us making that money.
Yeah, I mean, the line I have when I pitch our memberships is that, you know, the CCA is the only not-for-profit movie theater in the region, which is true. So our programming decisions and the allocation of our resources is not dictated by ticket sales or popcorn sales. You know, we'll play things that are going to lose money because they're important for us to play. And so the ticket sales and the popcorn sales cover about 70% of my department's budget. So we have to be continually raising money. We have an appeal now to raise more money for the screen. So in a sense, you might say like, oh, you're just going to, you know, take on another screen and lose more money. Well, we'll have some efficiencies built into that. But what has always been true is that there's people who really appreciate being able to see the kinds of films and the kind of exhibits that the CCA provides, and people who understand that the city would be much poorer without it. And in fact, our partnership with the city of Santa Fe is based on us providing community services in a broad sense. The city works in partnership with the Food Depot and the Humane Society, who provide what they call essential services to the city. So they're now considering what the CCA is providing an essential service, which is really an amazing thing to think about. And it's very forward-looking from the city of Santa Fe. And we're taking that really seriously. We'd feel very responsible to the city of Santa Fe to make sure that we use the resources that we have to really make this community as strong as we can.
There's been quite a bit of discussion as the whole question of what schools are for keeps getting raised in this world where we've got charter schools and we've got problems facing public schools and so on. And the idea that schools, which are the sort of definition of essential service, are to help young people grow into citizens of a community and of a country. The arts are part of kind of citizen building, citizenship building in a lot of ways, I think.
And also, you know, one of the things that, I mean, it gets a little bit of lip service, but, you know, the arts help develop the brain and the emotions in a way that allow you to captivate math, science, and the other subjects in a way that you wouldn't have. I mean, I don't have any statistics or studies in the back of my pocket, but it's obvious that kids who are exposed to art and music and film do better in math, science, and everything else. It's really, as Jason said, I think it's a great piece of recognition, and kudos to the mayor and the city council for recognizing that this is a key service. You know, years ago, I ran a program at Open Hands. It was called Art with Elders. And I was getting a grant from the State Arts Commission. And they wanted to know how what I was doing was going to increase tourism. And I thought, well, what are you talking about? I'm sending, you know, people to do workshops in nursing homes. How's that increase tourism? But I thought I better come up with an answer. So what I came up with is a community that serves its seniors with the arts, obviously, or a community that is supposed to be an art center must serve its seniors and young people and disabled people with the arts. And they bought it. They thought that was a good answer, you know, and I think that's fair enough. I think if you want to say that Santa Fe is a tourist mecca, then you have to say that the city supports cultural organizations. I mean, it goes with it. I mean, Europe does it all the time, right? Canada does it.
It's fundamental to this society.
I think the American Project has always been built on, you know, critical thinking and you know, science and cultural expression, as opposed to what a fascist society would be, which is to really limit the amount of information that citizens have and to curtail their critical thinking so they all think as one. I mean, that's the difference mm-hmm. between an open society and a closed society. And I think you can see pretty obviously some forces in this culture that want to limit, you know, free thinking, and you know, there's a move to undermine public universities and to cut back on arts funding and et cetera.
And so, this has been going on for a long time.
A long time. And so it's left to, you know, the cultural workers, to you know, the artists, the storytellers, the curators, the administrators and nonprofits to kind of keep this flame burning.
And all the people who take that work in. As a friend of mine said, everyone wants to be a writer, but I don't want to be a writer. I'm a reader. And it's those readers and those viewers who complete the loop.
Yeah, and you know, talking about Latin America again, when you think about a country like Cuba, which has nothing in terms of commercial goods, but if you graduate from high school and you wanted to be a dancer and you're pretty good at it, you could go try out for one of the companies. And there are lots of them at all different levels. You may never perform, but you could be a dancer full time. Because if you get accepted by one of these companies, all you got to do is show up every morning and rehearse, and you get a paycheck. In this country, we don't have anything like that, really. You want to be an artist, if you don't make it, there's a restaurant where you could be a waitress. But that's not the case in a place like Cuba, which is kind of an interesting how they give importance to it. And in fact, their artists are among the most successful economically because they see their artists as ambassadors of their philosophy. So if you're a Cuban artist and you're having an exhibit in New York, people are going to come see you and they're going to see, wow, this is a Cuban guy. You know, I thought you guys were all in gray and, you know, in handcuffs. And that's not the case at all. They're as hip as an artist in Paris.
And a place like Cuba, I mean, I remember talking to people when I was there. I haven't been there for a long time, but I would ask them, you know, how do you survive? You've had some really rough times economically. How do you survive? And they say, our music, our dance, you know, our basically the arts were what allowed these people to survive and not be in a state of continual despair or depression.
Right, and they've adjusted their thinking to what's available. So, you know, if you want to have your friends over, it doesn't mean you have to have the right canopies. You could just have cold water, you know, because it's not about what you're going to be offered. You know, it's about being together and having a conversation or whatever it is that you're doing together. And I think that may be true in a lot of other places, not just Cuba, but that's my experience.
So the CCA is reopening The Screen, which is this wonderful movie theater on the campus of the former College of Santa Fe, Santa Fe University of Art and Design. When is the reopening?
Our first screenings will be July 13th. So we're going to be running films throughout that week. And then the Santa Fe Arts Commission is going to partner with us on an outdoor screening on July 14th at the Bandstand.
What are you screening?
Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Nice.
There will be live music starting at 6 and swing lessons and all kinds of entertainment, food trucks, and then the film. It's going to be great.
Before we go, I want to just give a shout out to Brent Cleaver, who was the kind of beating heart of The Screen for many years. And he was also at the CCA. When I first moved here, I remember coming to the CCA and he would give these impassioned, super nerdy introductions to almost any film that you saw. And it was great. And I thought, I like this place.
He has not lost, an ounce of the kind of impassioned, super nerdy. We just talked about basketball for about an hour and a half last week. And we talk about films the same way. Brent is, he's my mentor in this business. And when I started at CCA, you know, The Screen was the place. I mean, it was considered one of the great art houses in the country. It was one of the great art houses in the country. All kinds of great new films, really elaborate retrospectives, the kind you'd only get in kind of New York and LA. And so we're taking that legacy really seriously too. I mean, over the last few years, it's lost a little bit of its luster. Brent, you know, didn't have as much leeway in programming the way he wanted to. The school was running things. So, and he's going to stay on our staff as a curator.
Yay.
And we're going to try to get that fire burning full brightness again.
Jason Silverman is director of the Cinematheque at the CCA. Stuart Ashman is executive director and chief curator. You can find out more on the web at ccasantafe.org. And don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, this series called Mexico Today Beyond the Wall is just opening this week. And Estado Profundo, Deep State, is another piece of the whole thing. Again, more information at ccasantafe.org. Thank you so much, both of you, for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.